Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for joining us for the Copernic Global Investors quarterly conference call. On today's call, we have David Ivan, Founder, Chief Investment Officer, and Lead Portfolio Manager, to discuss Copernic's views on the current market environment and the portfolio positioning of its global all-cap strategy. Please note, this call is being recorded and the topics on this call are for informational purposes only and should not be regarded as a recommendation or an offer to buy or sell any product or service to which this information may relate. Certain products or services may not be available to all entities or persons. Please consider all risk carefully before investing. All participants will initially be in a listen-only mode. Following Mr. Ivan's discussion, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. To ask a question, please press star 1 on your touchtone phone. At this time, I'd like to turn the call over to Nick Roberts.
Thank you, Noah. Good afternoon, and thank you all for joining us. Before I turn it over to Dave for some commentary on our portfolio as well as thoughts on the market, let me briefly update you on our firm and the Copernic Global All Cap strategy. As a firm, we currently manage just north of $1.9 billion in assets under management. After a difficult third quarter, we've had a strong start to October, and the Copernic Global All Cap strategy is down approximately 0.51% year-to-date through yesterday, October 14th, versus the MSCI All Country World Index benchmark return, down roughly 4.1%. At the end of today's comments, we will open up the lines to questions from the listening audience, and we look forward to hearing from you. Your feedback and commentary is always helpful to us, and we strive to be as forthcoming and transparent regarding the Copernic Global strategy as possible. In closing, on behalf of all 35 of us at Copernic, I'd like to thank you for your continued support and advocacy. We realize that it hasn't been easy owning our portfolio over the last few years, but as we approach Copernic's two-year anniversary on November 1st, we look to the future with a continued steadfast conviction in our process, our people, and most importantly, our portfolio. Dave, thank you as always for doing these calls. The stage is yours.
All right. Thanks, Nick. Good afternoon, and thanks to everybody for dialing in. It continues to be a fascinating stock market. There's going to be no shortage of things to talk about. We're not going to be talking about our guesses on what the Fed's going to do. We will talk about where we see tremendous opportunity amongst all the peril this market offers. We've talked a lot the last couple of years about the bifurcation in the market. The market's continued to be very, very bifurcated. Maybe there's evidence this is starting to change. We'll see. But the valuations are at fairly extreme levels. On page 8, you can see in front of you, the S&P 500 is a stone's throw away from its all-time highs. It is 18 times higher than it was when I came into the business. It was a nice time to be in the business. In addition to the 18 times, there's been dividends. As the S&P flirts near all-time highs, the emerging markets continue to bounce along multi-year lows. Bifurcation, why is it happening? We've talked about various things with passive investing and other non-efficient forms of market analysis. But to put it in different terms, right now, as we see analytical tools, I think the crystal ball is held in unusually high esteem, and valuation metrics are something nobody much cares about anymore. That, we think, provides both peril and opportunity. Everywhere I go, I get questions about clarity, certainty, catalyst. These are good things. We like them. Yeah, clarity, being able to see some things better than not being able to see things. Having certainty of future cash flows is better than having uncertainty, and having a catalyst is a nice thing. We see a couple problems. The main thing is, people are overpaying for these attributes. These are nice attributes, but everything's worth a price. We'll get into how much they're overpaying for them. But in addition to overpaying for them, in much of real life, and especially in the financial markets, these things don't really exist. Yeah, when people think that they have certainty about the future, they don't. Yeah, there's reams of stuff you can read about history or about behavioral psychology. I'll leave that up to everybody. But let's just say that it often turns out to be a mirage, or as Warren Buffett put it, the only value of stock forecasters is to make fortune tellers look good. Let's go with other views on market timing. We've got a lot of people that have been good over the years, but as Bernard Baruch says, only liars manage to always be out during the bad times and in during the good times. Our main point today is that during times of extreme value, it's important to get in when the values are extremely cheap and get out when the values are extremely dangerous and not try to time it perfectly. Let's go through some of the major inflection points in history. In the 1920s, we all are aware of the bubble then. A lot of people were concerned in 1927, very concerned in 1928, but by 1929 there was famous pronouncements about how it was going to continue forever. It didn't. If you got out too early, it was a little painful, but so what? The important thing was that you got out. There wasn't much that went up back in those days. When the market was crashing, gold was one. There were places to be back then. That's the important thing, not being in the market when it was too expensive, being in gold when it was too cheap. Moving on to 1974, that, of course, is the market that's maybe the most like the current market of any market, the Nifty 50 market, where, like now, people paid a lot of money for perceived certainty in terms of the Nifty 50. But like today, worrying about certainty or worrying about timing was the wrong thing to do. The right thing to do was get out. But like now, I guess, when you can get out, there were places to go. As the stock market was falling apart in 73 and 74, commodities went up. We're using gold here, but oil, land, a lot of metals all went up. The important thing in 1972 was to be out of financial assets and be in real assets, and the timing was less important. If we look at Japan, also similar to today, like today, one country was valued on par with all the rest of the countries in the world put together. This was a mistake. As a global investor, not being in Japan was painful in 88, 89, but so what? If you were early, the important thing was to get out. It eventually fell over 80%, and worrying about the timing was the wrong thing to do. Paying attention to the valuation was the right thing to do. Get out of the expensive market and get into the bargains. The bargains back in 1990 were U.S. stock market. You can see as the Nikkei went from 37,000 down to eventually 6,000 or so, the S&P 500 did very, very well. So, once again, trying to time when to get out of Japan or into get in the U.S. was the wrong thing to do. Getting out of the expensive thing into the bargains was the right thing to do. Many of you were in the business for the tech mania. Those of us that are value-oriented investors, we still remember how painful it was not being in tech in 98 and 99. But the important thing was not being in it, because that was way less painful than being in it a little bit too long as the NASDAQ fell on 90%. Once again, while the NASDAQ was going up and it was painful, not only the NASDAQ, it was very painful, I can tell you firsthand, to own small cap value stocks that went down while this was all happening. But once again, in the long run, timing didn't matter. What mattered was that you did own small cap value stocks. They were extremely cheap, and they went straight up into the 90% drop in the NASDAQ and the 50% drop in the S&P. We could go into 07 and other ones, but I think we've probably more than made the point. It is predictions that don't matter, and it's valuations that do matter. We don't know the future. We do know bargains. So let's talk about that. Let's start with where people are overvaluing certainty and clarity and catalysts. People are undervaluing patience. Yeah, to be a good investor, a lot of famous value investors have talked over the years about how patience is really paramount. To be able to, as the dictionary says, have the capacity to accept or tolerate delay, trouble, suffering. being early, that's suffering. We all know that. But the important thing is to have the patience to do it. As Howard Marks says, cycles always prevail eventually. John Templeton says, hold them until they work. Seems pretty obvious. It's best to be patient through the pain. Another Howard Marks, investors score their biggest gains when they buy underpriced assets, average down unfailingly, until their analysis proves out. We have a view on intrinsic value, and we'll spend the rest of the time talking about the potential reward for having the patience to see this out. So let's go with a game show. I'm not much of a game show fan, but here's one from the 1960s that many of you know. In the game show, people are given something of value. They then have the right to exchange that value for the unknown. Do they want to keep something or gamble that door number one or door number two or door number three might have something more of value? I guess various things are important. One is how valuable what you already have is and what the potential is from behind the doors. Last quarterly commentary, we talked about a different way of looking at the same thing. We talked about the patience of waiting if somebody is spending billions of dollars and really decades of time, and there's no exaggeration there, decades of time to build a hydroelectric dam or build a gold mine or a uranium mine or a coal mine or railroads. Decades go into this, and every now and then the stock market decides to let you have it for 90% off. So years of other people's work are given to us pretty cheaply. But as we all know, being patient and buying decades worth of work for a song doesn't mean that further patience isn't required. So let's talk further examples. We own things at really one-fifth of what we think they're worth. A lot of things we think are worth 2, 3, 5, 10 times what they're worth. So what do we do about that? Back to the game. If somebody has something of value, shown in the bottom right in the form of currency, should they hold on to the currency or should they exchange it for what's behind one of the other curtains? The point I guess we want to make, having just been on the road and meeting a lot of people, very good meetings, very enjoyable. If I could sum up the view of most people I've talked to recently is, yeah, we get it. We all know that value will have its day again. It always has and it always will. It'll have its day in the sun. We know that someday emerging markets will do well and resources will do well and gold will do well. Monopolies that provide basic needs will do well. But why now? Yeah. Couldn't this last for a couple more years? What's the catalyst? That seems to be people's concern. We wish to point out that while we don't know the answers to those questions, the potential reward for patience is huge. To put this into perspective, you take the cash for what's behind the upper right curtain for a treasury bond, you have certainty. You have pretty much certainty that you will get 2% a year and get your money back at the end of 10 years. The bond will fluctuate, but if you hold it for the whole 10 years, you will not, in a nominal sense, lose any money, and you will make 2% a year. That's pretty assured. So let's say instead of doing that, you say, nah, we want to buy one of those things on the previous page. We want to buy one of these gold mines that's worth 5 times what it's selling at in a normal environment. We want to buy these uranium mines that are worth 3 times what they're selling at, and gas properties in Russia that are worth 5 to 10 times what they're selling at. But we don't know the timing. So what we have on the left side of the page is putting this in perspective. We all hope it works tomorrow. I hope that these things work this quarter, next quarter, and they probably will work in the near future. But what if they don't? That's the question people ask. Well, let's say a stock is going to double. If it doubles this year, obviously we make 100%. If we have to wait 2 years, as the chart shows, we're making 41% a year. If we have to wait 3 years, we're making 25% a year. If we have to wait the entire 10 years, which would be shockingly long for value to play out, we'd be making 7% a year. So if the prospect is you can make somewhere between 100% a year and 7% a year, but we don't know which or when, do you want that or do you want the certainty of 2% a year? The market is voting. They want 2% a year. We think that's a colossal mistake. And we think that almost all of you, all your clients, everybody I know, pensions, endowments, you name it, 2% a year is guaranteed failure. It will not meet their needs. Whereas between 7 and 100% a year will easily make people's needs. And I've used the two times. There are a lot of properties right now that we think are trading at 20 cents on the dollar. Could potentially things go up 5 times. There again, if it takes 10 years for that to happen, that's 17% a year. So we wish we knew the timing, but we're willing to take huge returns and not know the timing, and we are certainly willing to forgo the lack of temptation of 2% a year with certainty. So we think this is an extremely, extremely good time to be buying great monopoly, oligopoly, basic resource, hard-to-replicate assets that have 2, 3, 5, 10 times upside. Really amazing times. To change pace a little bit, for the last couple of years, the values in the market have been heavy assets, and for the most part still are. But it's been a little bounce lately, but I think we've all kind of noticed that it's looking a lot like the market is struggling. It's lacking a lot of breadth. Way more stocks over the last year have hit new lows and hit new highs. This is actually good news because this is giving us opportunities to buy some things outside of just the things you're used to seeing in the last couple of years. As the market has fallen apart in the last 3 months, we've been able to buy a semiconductor company at less than half of the invested capital. We've been buying real estate in emerging markets for less than half of what they're easily worth. The first time we bought a developed market oil company in many, many years with MEG, we've been able to buy a media company with Pandora Media that got down to a $2 billion market cap for the far and away leader in internet radio. You look at the market caps on some of the terrestrial radio companies, really fascinating time to do that. We've been able to, a year and a half ago, we were able to buy oil tankers for way less than they're worth. Now people are liking oil tankers again, but they hate dry bulk tankers, so we've been buying dry bulk tankers for less than half of what they're worth. That's very interesting to us. Within the golden resources, we've been able to tweak that a little bit as people decide they like some names better and some names worse. So we've been able to say trims and terras. People are less worried about Kazakhstan than they used to be and move it into Newmont, which a lot of the big caps, the gold cars and Newmonts and companies that have really been too expensive for us to own in the past have moved into our criteria. So there has been some changes in the portfolio. So we're still loving the assets that are being given away. We're still loving the emerging market dominant franchises that are being given away. And now there's more companies that are moving into really incredible bargain basement prices. So that's where we are now with the massive overvaluing in some of the major stocks. There is massive undervaluation in great franchises and great assets. And What's required is diligence and patience. So that's really all I want to say is dialogue. I wanted to spend most of the time with Q&A, which I think is generally the most helpful. So with that, let's take questions.
Thank you. And if you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, press star 1 to ask a question, and we'll take our first question from John Smith with Merrill Lynch.
Good afternoon, David, and thank you for your presentation. I know that you are at heart a value-based, fundamentals-oriented investor, and you got a track record to show for it. That said, I'm sure you've been asked plenty of questions about catalysts to get the fund to, you know, to realize the value that's apparent in the presentation. Are you seeing, since this is a hard asset, tangible asset type portfolio, what are you seeing or hearing from your companies about general economic demand around the world? There is the consensus view, strong dollar will prevail, there's deflation out there, the world economy is slowing down, China's upside down, but there are other world economic indicators that should suggest otherwise, like the demand for oil. What are your companies saying to you about general economic activity that perhaps would give you some comfort that the value at some point is going to play itself out?
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. On the question of the catalysts and what we're seeing out there, I think I'm hearing that question the most I've heard since 1999, which was the last time people thought catalysts and worldviews were more important than valuation. Value works way more often than it doesn't work, but it has its cycles. And when value's in favor, all you hear from anybody is Graham and Dodd or the Bible of this business, and people quote Buffett and they quote Marx and they quote Templeton and they quote everybody, all of whom say, don't pay attention to these things. Do not pay attention to economic forecasts. The time to buy is when things are bad. And I think Templeton goes as far as to say everybody asks where things are good. And he said that's the wrong question. You need to ask where things are troubled. Where are they challenging? And that's where the opportunity is. Well, I think it's Rothschild that goes so far as to say buy when there's blood in the streets. We're not advocating that. But we think the right time to buy is when things look tough. And the right time to sell is when things look like they're going to be good forever. To more specifically answer your question, yeah, it does not seem like there's a lot going on well in the world. I don't see from much of any companies that things are wonderful, which it's dangerous enough buying expensive stocks when things look good, but a lot of the, say, U.S. stocks are fairly expensive on the illusion that things look good out there. As a matter of fact, the market seems to be going up every time they come out with weak numbers, you know, today's industrial numbers or whatever. People say, oh, good, weakness, let's buy stocks. That's particularly dangerous. At the same time, when it comes to resources and agriculture and energy and emerging markets, things look bad there. But everybody knows things look bad there, and they've priced it into the stocks. They have way, way, way more than priced it into the stock. And so if you believe that the world is cyclical, that in the long run, there will be good times and bad times for resources and good times and bad times for emerging markets and good times and bad times for gold and good times and bad times for food and you name it, then you should just focus on buying great values, which usually means buying when things look tough. Buying emerging markets 4 years ago when things looked good was a mistake. Buying the U.S. 4, 5, 6 years ago when things looked bad was a wonderful thing to do. Buying the U.S. right now when things look okay is potentially dangerous. Buying the things people loved 4 years ago and hate now because there are challenges, we think it's really good. So, as a value-oriented investor, like you say, I say value is everything. price is all that matters. Howard Marks points out that you can buy bonds that are already in default. 100% of them are in default. And if you buy them cheap enough, your risk is very low and your reward is very, very high. So, no, we're not buying anything because we think the world looks wonderful. The world will be fine. But we are buying things because they are very inexpensive, which history, logic, everything would suggest means the risk of this portfolio is pretty low right now, and the potential reward is very, very high. 4 years ago, when things looked much better and we were coming off 12 great years, the risk was higher than people perceived and the potential return was lower. We think that risk and return are functions of valuation more than anything else. So, no, we're not hearing from a lot of companies that, oh, the world's getting better. This is pure value investing.
And we'll take our next question from Matija Schechter with Battery Global Advisors.
Hey, so I actually have two questions, if that's okay. The first one is if you have any strong views on the MLP sector and if that's starting to get at all attractive to you. And the other is how committed you are to this being a hard asset portfolio, if that's more just a reflection of where valuation is today. But 15 years from now, you could actually have, you know, no hard assets and a whole bunch of stuff that right now is, I guess, the antithesis of that based on where valuations might be 15 years from now.
Yeah. MLP is probably a good example of where people were so thrilled with the area a year or two ago that it was a dangerous time to buy them. At a lot cheaper prices, of course, they're more interested, more interesting. So there's a lot of things we're looking at now that we weren't earlier. With those things, you have to worry about tax things. You have to worry about other issues, and what we may or may not be about to buy, I won't comment on. But that is an example of things that are liked a lot less than they were a year or two ago and are a lot cheaper. But the second question along that same line, right to the heart of what we do, it is definitely that's where the values are. We are not a hard asset mandate. If you look at my career, I came in early 80s when everybody loved hard assets, really loved hard assets. They loved gold. I was shorting gold companies. Yeah, they hated financial assets. They hated stocks and bonds. They hated consumer names. They hated drug names, and that's what we own. The 80s and 90s, I had really no interest in hard assets. It was all buying good franchises that were going to grow nicely. But then around the turn of the century, then things started to change. People started to pay way too much for growth. They started giving away different things, and we took advantage of it. In 2003 is when we first heavily went into hard assets, but it was not gold. It was industrial metals, copper and zinc and lead and nickel, and we owned fertilizer and you name it. 4 years later, those were all gone. We still had hard assets. We just moved into the gold stocks because gold had gone up and gold stocks had gone down, and that was an incredible opportunity to buy gold in the ground for way less than its liquidation value, and we owned a lot of that. 2009, we were able to buy some industrials back. By 2011, all the industrial metals were gone again, and a lot of the gold was gone. The stocks went up five times, and we still more than lowered our exposure from 25 to 11%. So obviously, we sold lots and lots of gold stocks. Now, the last couple of years, hard assets are being given away again. Like 99, people will pay a lot of money for a nice story. Now it's more biotech than tech, but and they are giving away assets. But the assets, like I say, 1 year we own some assets, another year we own some other assets, and hopefully 5 years from now we'll own next to nothing in assets because they will have run up 10 times, and people at that time will be back to hating financial assets again. And so that's what we do. Yeah, we People will say, well, your portfolio looks rather macro. We point out that we think it's the opposite. We think the marketplace is millions of people who collectively, as a crowd, go to extremes. The indexes are cap-weighted. The markets are cap-weighted. The market goes to extremes. The market bought too much oil in 1980, and they bought too much Japan in 89, and they bought too much tech in 99, and they bought too much finance in 07, and they're buying too much U.S. right now. And that prices things out of our range. But they decided they hated oil in 03. We bought it. They hated gold in 08. We bought it. They hated emerging markets in 08, 09. We bought some. And right now, the hatred for some of the emerging markets and for gold and increasingly other commodities now is a tremendous opportunity. But we certainly do not own them. Back to an earlier question, we do not own them because we think the world's going to grow at 5% or 3 or minus 1. We have no opinion on that. We buy it because the market is giving these things away. And it quite likely will be very different 3 or 4 years from now.
Great. Thank you so much.
And as a reminder, it is star 1 if you'd like to ask a question. And we'll take our next question from Aubrey Sharfman with Morgan Stanley.
Hi, Dave. Your insights are always very, very much appreciated. And I was wondering if you could expand in as much detail as possible your theory with respect to coal. From the other mutual fund value managers I speak with, other top analysts with the major wirehouses, even those from a value standpoint who do embrace the coal theme and that coal is not going away for the long haul, a lot of them still question Peabody as the way to play that theme, given some of the risks if natural gas stay down and given when some of their maturations of bonds are coming through in a few years. So any updates you can give us on your thinking with respect to coal as a theme, and more importantly, why specifically Peabody?
Okay, thanks. Good question. We, to the previous question, we buy what the market wants to give away. And things with warts usually trade at a discount to things without warts. But we are in a market right now where things without warts are obscenely expensive, and things with warts are generally too cheap, and things with major warts are being given away. And so, you know, the way we try to do analysis is we say, all right, we're not pure value, buy things just because they're cheap. We do the opposite. We value businesses and then insist that they're cheap before we buy them. So we don't buy things just on a low PE or low price of book. And then we try to risk adjust and buy when we can. And then we say, when things get bad, is this secular or is this cyclical? And if it's secular, we move on. But many things are cyclical. So if coal is going to go the way of wood in terms of meeting the needs of the world, then we're wrong. This is a secular change, and coal is gone. We believe it's cyclical. We think people loved coal in the 70s, and they hated coal in the 90s. And 4 years ago, the worry wasn't, oh, my God, natural gas is cheap. The world was, how are we ever going to get enough coal and gas and oil and solar and you name it to meet the needs of this 7.3 billion people out there? And so we look around and say, well, what do we think of coal? We say, well, we don't like a lot about it. We don't like the sulfur, we don't like the ash, we don't like the CO2, we don't like the sulfur dioxide, the nitrous oxide. You know, there's a lot of things not to like about coal. But there's a lot of things to like about it, too. It's very cheap energy, and countries like China have it. And with all China's good things, they have a billion very, very poor people. They're going to keep using coal, and India is going to keep using coal. Hopefully they'll come up with way way cleaner technology. We think, we can go into this in depth, but we think that after coal growing for pretty much my entire lifetime, coal has grown every year except for the last year, year and a half. Now it's not going, it's shrinking. It's been losing share for a long time, and it will continue to lose share for a long time. It will probably be a shrinking business. We hope it will be a shrinking business, but it is not going away. It is where it is with the growing economies of the world, growing the slowest they have for a long time. It's growing with demand for coal for steel at incredibly low levels. It's going to go up. So the time to buy coal is not 4 years ago when people are worried about not having enough on it. The time to buy it is when people are scared to death that low gas prices are going to be the end of coal, and they're somewhat competitive and somewhat not. I guess we'll never meet all of our baseload electricity needs. And so buy things on the bottom of the cycle. Now, the other part of your question is, how do you play it? And we've played it various ways. We've played Shenhua, where we made money. Maybe that's potential for the future. We've made good money three times in the past on Arch, but over a year ago, we decided that Arch had a lot more risk to it than Peabody, and turns out it did, although both stocks are probably down pretty equally. And we moved to Peabody. We have not ever owned any of these ones that have gone bankrupt. Never in the past have we owned them, have not owned them. People think that coal's going away. We think they're wrong. If they think Peabody's one of the ones going bankrupt, we think they're wrong. Do they have too much debt? Yes. Do they have a management team that's made all kinds of mistakes? Yes. Are they going to destroy value? Yes. Fortunately, this is before the split, the reverse split. We were seeing $60 a share in value. I'll multiply that by 15 now, but so if it's worth 900. Then what now? Well, you look at their debt structure over the next 5 years. They have another year and a half of lease payments to the government that are going to hurt them, but then that rolls off. They have some big debt payments, as you suggest, but they've got the cash to handle that. They could lose money three of the 5 years. And so that's a potential problem. So are things going to be uncomfortable for them? Yes. But do they have the cash flow to meet these payments? Even if coal stays on its ass for 5 years, we think yes. Yeah, we've got the tables. We can show you our numbers. And then besides that, if you have $60 on the pre-reverse split shares and you sell properties at the bottom, buying at the top and selling at the bottom, stupid, we don't approve of that, but they did it, they're doing it. So let's say they sell properties for cash at a bad price and the intrinsic value per share drops from 60 times where the stock is selling at to only 40 times where the stock is selling at, but the market then finally gets the point they're not going bankrupt, then there could be a huge upside. If they refinance the debt, restructure it like Arch did, Arch stock went up huge, briefly up seven times just on the announcement that they had restructured the debt. Now, restructure of debt is transferring equity value to bondholder value. We suppose that Peabody will probably do that too. So once again, the value per share will probably fall. But when the stock is selling at 40 to 60 times what the market's pricing it at, as net of all debt, they can give away a lot of value, and we can still easily make 5, 10, 15, 20 times our money from here. If the market's sure of bankruptcy and it's probably not going to happen, that's where you have a huge, huge upside. So we think, oh, and another point, yeah, we've always, and we've talked about this in the past, if we're buying and somebody else is selling, I'd like to know why they're selling. If they're selling because their analysis comes up with something different than ours, then hopefully we're right, but we might not be. If they're selling for non-economic reasons, if they're selling because they can't take the political pressure, which if there is huge political pressure for owning coal, that's good. They're selling for non-economic reasons. If they're selling because the Obama administration hates it, then that's good. If they're selling it because the government of Norway forced people to sell, that's good. If they're selling it because the government of California is not allowing purchases and they may require sales, then that's good. So, yeah, we can all talk about what the true intrinsic value is. We think it's 40 times higher, but we know people are selling it at prices that are lower than they otherwise would if they were doing it on an economic basis. As investors, we love that. You know, we love buying high-yield bonds when the SNLs were being forced to sell them. We loved buying Halliburton and Pfizer and things like that when people were selling anything that had asbestos in it. People sell for non-economic reasons. That's a beautiful thing in the long run, and that's what we think is going on with Peabody. We think there's a lot of things to hate. People hate it way too much.
Thank you.
And once again, as a reminder, it is star one if you'd like to ask a question. That is star one. We'll pause briefly. And we'll take our next question from Igor Lotsvin with Merrill Lynch.
Yeah, thank you. Great call. Quick question. Pandora Media seems like a bit out of the beaten path for you guys. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Certainly. Thank you. Yeah, I think on an earlier question whether we're always hard assets, I'd mentioned how we'd move from one asset to another and certain times had less assets. What I didn't mention then was in 2009 we bought eBay and Microsoft and Whole Foods Markets and, you know, the Indian growth companies, and we're buying emerging market banks, things that weren't in our portfolio at all before. You know, we love these things. It's just the market usually loves them more than we do. But whenever the market wants to let us have a potentially valuable franchise, we are happy to be on the other side of this. So, yeah, a year ago you had most things being very, very expensive. And now it's mostly sort of biotech, consumer, and social media. The rest of technology's come down. Yeah, so to be able to buy Wu Hong or things like that, bargains are good. Now we're selling BitAl because it's getting taken over. But to be able to buy a Pandora, this is a stock that people were excited about in the past. This is this is a company where people were saying, all right, they dominate internet radio, and they have a cost advantage over the Apples and the Googles and the Spotifys, and they're at a disadvantage versus terrestrial radio, but they're still taking tons of share from these people because they have a way better model. And maybe they'll even get a more level playing field, so maybe there's huge, huge upside to this. And there is huge, huge upside, but now people are focused on the downside, which is also true. It is true that Apple will probably make a big push, and Google, of course, is always making a push, and that maybe the regulatory rulings go in their favor, but maybe they don't, and people are focused on this. All we know is that when you see things like Clear Channel go out 8 years ago with $19 billion, and we can buy somebody with 85% share of pure internet radio for $2 billion, which it was when we bought that, we're happy to do that. Clearly a good company, clearly huge potential upside, clearly some risks also. But we are more than happy to buy things like this when the market, as it's known to do once and again, has let us have growth stocks at value prices. We like that. Just doesn't happen all that often.
Thank you.
We'll take our next question from Alan Rudnick with Barnaby Corp.
Hi, David. Good presentation, as usual. My question relates to, and you showed past periods where gold did very well, when other things didn't. Could you just talk about the inflation environment at those times and the inflation environment now? Right now it looks like we're on the edge of deflation in some sectors, and so I'm just wondering how important inflation is to the thesis of gold and gold mines.
Okay, thanks. Probably a lot of people are cringing knowing that I could spend 2 hours answering that, but I promise I won't. Inflation, of course, is a fascinating topic. I am old school. I believe that printing money is inflation by definition, period. So I would say, whereas right now the U.S. has no inflation because we're not printing money, there's rapid inflation in Europe and Japan, and 3 years ago there was no inflation in Europe and there was hyperinflation in the U.S. We quintupled our money supply. It's just awesome inflation. Of course, it all went into the bond market and the stock market and the housing market and the collectibles market and the art market, and certainly healthcare costs have been screaming and tuition has been screaming. But the important thing, as I said earlier, we can have our views on inflation. Certainly we saw inflation 4 years ago as we were selling most of our commodities because the market was agreeing with it. Price is everything. Right now, you don't need any inflation for stocks that are already down 80-90% and are trading way below liquidation value to go up. That's one point. But another point, it's funny how people say, well, if interest rates go up, that's bad for gold. And somehow not bad for stocks and bonds. I think that people focus on nominal interest rates, and they really need to focus on real interest rates. So if people say, well, every time interest rates go up, gold goes down, I say, go look at the 1970s. The 1970s, interest rates went up huge. They went up from 3 or 4% to 22%. And why rates are going from a couple percent to 22%, gold went from $35 an ounce to $800 an ounce. And then you had two decades where interest rates went from 22% down to zero, and gold fell from 800 to 255. So nominal interest rates are the wrong thing to look at. And so, yeah, I tell people if interest rates go up because they replaced Janet Yellen with Paul Volcker and he ramps rates back to 22% and says we're going to kill inflation, gold's going down. God help stocks and bonds. It's over. But, gold will go down. If rates go up like they usually go up, because the Fed always gets it wrong, and the Fed always lags behind inflation, and when it picks up, they're not going to believe it, and they're going to deny it. And like the 70s, rates will go to 2 when inflation's 3, and they'll go to 4 when inflation's 5, and they'll go to 8 when inflation's 9. Then gold's going to do tremendously well. So if anybody thinks the Fed is about to ramp rates to the moon, they should probably sell their gold, and they sure as hell should sell every stock and bond in their portfolio. That's highly, highly unlikely. I think that there's just about zero chance that they're going to crank up some huge real interest rates. And I also think, unless they really crank them up, like I said earlier, they quintupled the money supply over the last 7 years, gold has only gone from about 400 to 1200 while that's happening. That's only gone up three times. And so gold's undervalued now. It's undervalued versus the cost of pulling it out of the ground, incremental. Well, existing mines can pull it out, but incremental cost of production is much higher. The theoretical value, if we were to go back to a Bretton Woods standard, is way, way higher. And the stocks are so cheap that if I'm just completely wrong, I think we make money from here anyhow, and then we get huge optionality if we're right. So this is not an inflation play. Inflation's highly probable. But I think that this is just pure value. These are good companies with irreplaceable assets. The stock prices are 80, 90% lower than they were at the top and below liquidation value. And for free, we get an option on the fact that printing money might actually be inflation.
Okay, thank you. That answers it.
And we'll take our next question from Gary Magnuson with Morgan Stanley.
Mine sort of ties into that. Just was wondering if you had any more comments on really all the central banks kind of being at what rate issue, you know, putting money into the system to keep rates low. Does that have any precedence in history in terms of how they take it back? Or could the government, I mean, could the Treasury say to the government, we're just going to, when's a debit, when's a credit, we're just going to let it kind of wipe it off that way? Or, I don't know, it's kind of a silly question, but.
No, it's a very interesting question.
Currency.
Yeah. No, I will, I'm not an expert. I've read a lot. It's not something that doesn't have precedence in history. It's happened many times in history. They call it different things at different times when they printed lots of money in France in the late 1700s and printed it in Holland and printed it in Germany, and they printed it in Zimbabwe and Venezuela. Printing money is something that's happened a lot. And read history. Maybe some people out there may have found different things than I've found, but I have found when you print money, they never take it back. They can't. And if they were afraid to raise rates, you know, 15 years ago when things weren't that bad, and then they were afraid to raise rates 10 years ago and 5 years ago, and now there's more debt in the system than there ever has been in the history of our country, and they're not even willing to raise a quarter point last month. It's highly, highly unlikely they ever take the money out. And they're all taking turns passing the baton, which country prints this quarter and who's going to print next quarter and whatever. I suspect they keep printing and never take it out. But as a value investor, we have to buy the values. Buying values usually means we're buying stuff with the wind in our face, having to do what looks to all the world like it's going to be wrong. What a wonderful thing to buy really deeply valued franchises where the wind's at our back. It is quite probable that printing money now works like it did every other time in the history of mankind, in which case we're buying really, really cheap stocks that will work if there is no inflation, but there probably will be inflation. Oh, another thing, too, this happens through history, too. People say there can't be inflation when you have certain prices falling and you have slack in the economy and spare capacity. That is 100% wrong. Yeah, I think when people look at post-World War II and where you've had the Fed raise and lower rates and the economy picks up a little bit and shrinks a little bit, the CPI falls a little bit and gains a little bit, that's not inflation. Big-time inflation when central banks print way too much and cause huge problems always happens when the economy is doing bad and people are worried about joblessness and excess capacity in printing. And the more they worry and the more they keep interest rates too low and the more they inflate, the more they cause malinvestment. And so you keep rates at zero, and you allow people to drill like crazy to find oil, and they find the oil, and the price of oil goes down. People say that's deflation. That is not deflation. That is malinvesting causing too much supply, which causes the price of a certain commodity to drop, which then gives them cover to create more inflation, which causes more malinvestment. So, yeah, now I have all kinds of thoughts on it. Those thoughts are not embedded in the portfolio. Those are things we get for free. You know, we have stocks that are cheap. Inflation, deflation, economic growth, non-economic growth, donut. It's a bargain portfolio. But if, in fact, printing money does what it's always done every other time in the history of mankind, then we get a freebie.
Thanks.
And once again, if you would like to ask a question, you may do so by pressing star 1. Once again, that is star 1. We'll pause.
That's why we're waiting, I guess. And some people have asked questions about energy pricing. Maybe I semi-answered that with the last question, but... Yeah, like all things cyclical, people have gone from how are we ever going to get enough synergy to we'll have too much forever. The former view is wrong. This view will be wrong. Whether it's oil or coal or gold or copper, we say what would it cost to go build a brand new mine and do it profitably, and we call that the incentive price of production. Oil, we have felt for a long time that it's in the vicinity of $75, and we won't quibble with $65, and we won't quibble with $85. You'll notice we owned no oil in the portfolio when the price was well above $85. We didn't own any years ago, 07, when the prices were high. Now we don't think 50 is sustainable, so now we've been buying the price of oil. We think, as I mentioned, oil was overproduced because the central banks of the world induced malinvestment. The price should have fallen, did fall. It's unsustainably low now. It cannot stay there without eventually leading to shortages. So we like oil at these prices. As we mentioned earlier, coal was too expensive a few years back. It's too cheap now. We find that uranium is trading at half of the incentive production price. That cannot last, and that has been going up for the last year or so. We like lots of energy at this point, and we always try to be able to take the bargains, whether it's oil or gas or coal or solar or hydro. We go where the bargains are, and there's a lot more bargains in energy. As a side, the incentive price for gold, which isn't energy, of course, is we think close to 2,000. So things eventually get to their incentive price. Most forms of energy now have gone from too high a while back to too low now. So we like energy.
And we'll take our final question today from James Bauer, private investor.
Hi, David. Thanks for the call, and always enjoy your insights. I was maybe asking a question similar to what you were just talking about, but interested in your feeling about relative values between natural gas and uranium, because we seem to be able to discover more and more natural gas. They're both clean fuels, and I wonder a little bit whether some of the developing world may alter nuclear plans to natural gas because of the easy availability of it.
Okay, well, let's start with uranium. There's no sure things in the world, but that's as close to a sure thing, I think, as we've seen. There, you have tremendous fundamentals. You know, whether anybody should build a nuclear power plant is debatable, but there is a lot of them that have been built, and they're building 60 more. So there should be 60 more, and whether it turns out to be 70 or turns out to be 50, and whether Japan restarts theirs longer or faster or slower than people would expect, we don't know, and whether the Germans take theirs off, we assume they will. But certainly there will be a lot more plants, not less. But let's assume there'll be no new plants. The existing plants, once you've built a plant, it's debatable whether you should build a plant, but if it's built, it costs billions to build, and it costs next to nothing to run. The price of uranium is less than 3% of the cost of running that thing. If you build it, you're going to use it. They use more than have been mined, and they've done that for a dozen years already. You think, how can that be possible to use more than you've produced for a dozen years? Well, it's possible because the Department of Energy sells uranium, and it's possible because they've been reusing tailings, and it's possible because the Japanese weren't using it and were able to supply it, or it's possible because Russian bombs were being turned into fuel. 2 years ago next month, that ended. So that supply is cut off. The Department of Energy cannot sell forever. You can't run inventories down forever. So there will be a shortage unless mine supply picks up. It takes years and years and years, sometimes 20, 30 years to build these things, these uranium mines. So they better get on it. But no one's going to really start building a uranium mine until the price roughly doubles from here. The fundamentals, even if you assume there's no world growth, even if you assume that natural gas is a wonderful thing and it continues to grow and they find it and it takes share, that's a bad thing for coal. It doesn't affect uranium. Uranium, it's a matter of how fast the price goes up, not if. Gas is another thing. Gas, in a lot of ways, is better than oil. It's cheaper, cleaner. In other words, it's not as good as oil because it's hard to store and transport. Pipelines cost a lot of money, and liquefying costs a lot of money. You can have cheap gas in the U.S., and that's way different than having cheap gas in Japan. So being cheap one place does not mean it's cheap on the world, unlike oil. So our premise is that in the future you will see increased solar, you'll see increased wind, quite likely see increased gas, you'll see increased nuclear, hydro will stay even, plus or minus, coal will lose a little share, and oil much in a lot of those markets. But as far as what the right price for gas is, I don't know. The fracking hasn't worked a lot of places in the world, in the U.S. and a few other places, and it's debatable that if interest rates were 5% instead of 0, would people be able to pump money in the ground fast enough to keep this going long term? I don't know. Our way of looking at it is gas seems fine to us, where's the best value? By far, Gazprom. And so we own our gas there. The biggest, longest live reserves and cheapest and best infrastructure, you name it, in the world, and trading at one-tenth of what it would trade if it was in the U.S. Uranium seems like a sure thing. Gas in the U.S. we owned when people hated Chesapeake 6 years ago. We've owned it in Canada a few times where people didn't like that. But, we like gas. Fine. But the real bargains out there are we think, hydroelectric energy, uranium, and anything in Russia.
Thank you very much.
And we'd like to thank our callers for the questions today. At this point, I'd like to turn the call back over to Mr. Ivan for any additional or closing remarks.
All right. Well, once again, thanks to everybody for dialing in. They are fascinating times, and actually a lot of encouraging things starting to go on now. So we'll see how much more patience we need before value has its day. But certainly great companies at bargain prices this beats any time we've seen, and we'll see where it goes from here. Thanks again.
And that does conclude today's conference. Thank you for your participation.